Welcome to Career Tours. This week, Communicating Across the Language Barrier, Chapter 3, Written Communication, Part 1. The questions this class answers are, how do I present to an audience with a different first language to me? How do I work with a colleague who has a different first language to me? And how do I communicate across a language barrier?
Guaranteed managerial success. Don't you wish it were easy? Unfortunately, there are no silver bullets for successful management. It requires effort on the part of the manager to be dedicated to being more effective. While at our conferences, we don't pass out any silver bullets. We'll absolutely share with you our proven concepts for getting results and retaining employees so that the efforts you make are not in vain. Join us for an effective manager conference by registering online at manager-tools.com/training. We'll share with you strategies for making all of your efforts count.
Sarah, this is the third part, the last part of our series about communicating across the language barrier. We did the words you say and how you say them. Then we did body language and facial expression. And then the last part of the five behaviours is work product. And work product for a lot of people is written communication, reports and emails and Excel spreadsheets and things with writing in them. And as with the other parts, anytime you're writing something in a language which is your first language and you're giving it to someone for whom their first language is something different, there's a potential for that to go wrong, for that to be a miscommunication or a lack of understanding on their behalf. And we already know this, right? Because we can do written communication and miscommunicate with people who have the same first language as us.
Yes, exactly.
No, like if you've ever miscommunicated with a brother or sister who grew up in the same household, knows all the same things as you do, and speaks the same language, and you've written something and the other person has misunderstood, you know how easy it is to misunderstand written communication. So in this class, we're going to talk about how to make it easier if the people you're talking to have a different first language from you. So Sarah, what's our outline?
All right, our outline for this week is, number one, follow clear communication rules. Then include more metadata. Send materials ahead of time. Ask for questions ahead of time. Ask about previous experience and learn from your own experience. So let's start with the following clear communication rules. Now, we have an entire cast about writing effectively. We'll list the rules here to refresh your memory. The first few are similar to guidance we gave about your presentations, actions that make it easier for listeners or readers to understand the words that you're saying. And those are, use short, simple words, avoid jargon, avoid acronyms unless they're widely accepted, and avoid using bold and italics. Now, obviously, we didn't say avoid bold and italics when we're talking about spoken communication. That would be ridiculous. You might think that using bold and italics as emphasis makes written communication easier to understand. However, if the words are unfamiliar, the change in font actually does the opposite in that it makes it more difficult to understand. Bold and italics are an extra layer of information on top of whatever we're trying to say. We're trying to keep the information flow straightforward. So in that case, we want to leave them out.
And the same goes for different colored words or underlines or any other way you can distinguish words from one another, right? We'll keep them all in the same font, black and white, big enough to read, all that. So next up, when you string those words together, you can continue to keep your writing easy to understand. So short sentences with one idea per sentence. Fight to eliminate commas. If you have a comma, try and make it a period or a full stop. And two sentences. So I could say, my cat is called Ernie, comma, I got him from a rescue. Or I could do, my cat is called Ernie, period, I got him from a rescue, period. And it's just one idea per sentence. It's just way easier to understand because you're not trying to keep, we talked before about people keeping more than one idea in their head while they're listening to part of the sentence and then they kind of keep that in their head and they have to listen to the second part of the sentence and translate it and so on. So the short sentences help them because they only have to have one thing in their head at a time. And then paragraphs should be summarized by the first sentence, the topic sentence. So talking about commas, there is a famous sentence from the book A Tale of Two Cities by Dickens. I think it's the first sentence. In fact, I'm sure it was the first sentence. So it begins like this. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. And it goes on for another four lines. And all of those are commas. So it does have a pattern. It was the best of times, the worst of times. Those two things are opposites. But then it gives you two more opposites. And now you've got to keep the first two in your head and then you get to the second two. And this sentence is perfect grammatically. There was, you know, if you had a grammar expert say, read it and say, does it follow the rules? They would say yes. But because it's so long, it's hard to understand. Mm-hmm. I had to run my finger underneath the lines and in order to see where I was. So even
I'm looking at that next paragraph.
Yeah, even if I don't know how long it took you to get confused, but it took me not very long and I was reading it. So if you're listening and you got confused in that sentence, you know why we want you to have short sentences. Even if English is your first language, it's hard to follow a sentence that long.
Absolutely. And you can contrast that with something from Hemingway's Old Man and the Sea. Often, Miss Stein would have no guests, and she was always very friendly. And for a long time, she was affectionate. And there are no commas in that sentence, yet it's easy to understand. And as Wendy said, the punctuation, it's perfect in both those cases. Dickens and Hemingway are not incomprehensible. It's just that it's longer and harder to understand. And in both of those cases, let's all remember, you are not Dickens or Hemingway, and you are not writing literature. So don't try to write in a style, except a style that is easy for others to understand.
Only a few of us are probably writing novels as being at work, and those people probably aren't listening to Crittle. So let's forget trying to write in a way that looks nice or sounds nice, and think about a way of writing that is easy for other people to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ways to do that is to write the way you talk when possible. So what happens is we have a habit, people have a habit in general, of writing in a more formal language than the language they use when they're talking.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a license for a personal license for manager tools, you can download the show notes for each of the casts. And the show notes are not like show notes for other podcasts. They are entire, they're like essays. It's entire proper sentences, paragraphs, all that kind of stuff. And what happens is what is in the cast is not exactly what's said on the podcast, because what we do is Mark and I write the podcast, and then when Sarah or Kate or Mike and Mark and I are recording, we look at the paragraph and then we say what's in the paragraph in our own words. So we're not reading, like reading from a script, like a newsreader would. We're sort of interpreting it. And what happens is the words we use are different words, because when we talk, we use different words to the ones we use when we write. We have a habit of using words which are more complicated or interesting or erudite when we write. In a way that we don't when we talk, and we use gonna and wanna and coulda and all sorts of other words that maybe aren't perfect grammar.
Absolutely. And when you're learning a new language, the majority of your learning is coming from speaking and from listening. You're not learning from a formal book. If you're working with others, it's from talking to people that you work with. And you don't start reading Dickens. You start by watching a popular TV show or ordering a Starbucks. That's the first step is never the most difficult one. So writing in the way that you speak makes it easier for those who don't speak that same first language as you to communicate with you, because you'll be using language that they themselves are more familiar with, that they're using more often, not necessarily the types of words they would find in books, but the types of words they understand.
Yeah, there's a big difference between erudite and smart. And most of us who speak English as a first language can probably, if you don't actually know what erudite is, you can probably guess, or you can probably put it into context from what I said. But if you said smart, most people understand smart, because it's something that comes up frequently, not frequently, but in conversation, people will say that person is smart or that person is not, Or if you're in England, they'll say that person is clever, which is an insult in America somehow. I don't understand that quite. But people here are smart, as in intelligent, not as in well-dressed. It's the simplest word. It's the word I just used as an easy example. And yet, between England and America, it just takes three sentences of explanation.
And when you said that, I thought that person is bright. How confusing is that?
Yes, which is another word for clever, but in a different way.
But in a different way, but also means the amount of light in a room.
Yes, exactly.
Confusing.
That person is really bright, and somebody imagines like a halo.
Right? Like, what does that mean? They glow?
The last point of this is use the formula, or use the formula. If you go to the website, our website, and in the search box, you type write more effectively, that cast will come up. And in it, we give you a formula for assessing your writing for the ease of understanding. So how easy is it to understand by others? So this is what you do. You take a sample of 200 words or less, and you write down the exact number of words. So if you've got 198, you write down 198. And then you count the number of sentences. So anything that ends with a period, you could count the number of periods. That would tell you how many sentences you have. And then you count the number of words with three syllables or more. I copied this from that cast, and Mark wrote that cast. It says, now we come to the algorithm of great joy. I didn't realize that was there until I read it. And anybody who knows anything about me knows I hate math. So the idea of an algorithm bringing joy is mental. So now we divide the number of words, the 198, by the number of sentences, and we remember that number. So the goal is about 15. And then we divide the number of long words, those with three or more syllables, by the total number of words. And that gives you a number, a result less than one, and that's a percentage. So if you have 200 words and 50 long words, you divide 200 into 50, and your answer would be 25. It says here, you don't worry about the decimal, basically. I wouldn't worry about the decimal anyway. So your goal is to get 15. And then the last step is to add those two goal 15s together. And so your goal would be 30. 30 is really good. 30 means that your writing is as comprehensible as possible. Between 20 and 40 is probably okay for an English speaking or whatever your language is speaking audience. But the closer to 30 you are, the more easy it will be to understand, not just by people who speak a different language to you, but also people who speak your own language. So if you want to understand that more fully, understand the math and have Mark explain it, which will be better, make sure to listen to that Write More Effectively cast.
The next piece of this is include more metadata. Metadata is the information that goes at the beginning of a document or an email, the part that explains the context of it. It gives the reader an understanding and an expectation of what it is that they're about to read. It's like an orientation, a warm-up to it. Metadata also flows through a document to provide wayposts to keep the reader oriented so that they know where they are in the rollout of that metadata. And we just did it, right? We included an outline and a couple of paragraphs at the beginning of our guidance to remind you about behaviors that are included in communication, Wendy said it, right? And why communicating in writing is harder. Now you know what to expect, and it'll be easier for you to predict what follows next. Is this where we are in the rollout?
If this was a podcast that's just two talking heads, two people having a conversation, then you wouldn't get any metadata because people don't know where a conversation is going to go when they start the conversation. If you have dinner with a friend and they say, how's your car? Because you bought a new one, you could end up talking about anything, like a visit to Paris in 10 years. Whereas when you're communicating at work, there's a point to your communication. There's something you want to get over. There's an idea.
When it is written, yes.
Yeah, that you want to explain. And that's why it's important to have metadata, the data up front that tells people where we're going. Because whilst we're in a conversation, a casual conversation, it's okay. We can just go wherever. If we want someone to get the point, we have to guide them to that point. So that's why writing has sentences, paragraphs, and chapters. That's part of the metadata. When writing was first created, there was no punctuation. There were letters, and all of the letters were next to each other. whether they were in this word or that word, whether they were in this sentence or that sentence, whether they were in this paragraph or that paragraph, didn't matter. They just all flowed. And in some languages, they flowed left to right, and then they turned the corner and went right to left, which is very confusing. So Aristophanes, I don't know if that's how you say that.
I don't know how to say it. That's why I didn't do this paragraph. I'm like, I don't even know how to say that.
I'm going to call him Aristophanes of Byzantium added a dot between words where you were supposed to take a breath. So you would have a line of letters, and then halfway between the top of the letter and the bottom of the letter, or to the right-hand side of it, there would be a dot. And that would say, take a breath, just like a comma does.
Mm-hmm. Which is why it turned into our periods and our commas. The punctuation tells you where a sentence ends and another thought begins. This is where you breathe. And a paragraph tells you that the new idea or a new point is coming, right? A change in topic. Whereas a chapter tells you that a new scene is starting or a new idea is being proposed into the larger context of it. Sentences, paragraphs, chapters, all of these things help orient you in a long piece of writing. Headings and subheadings do this exact same thing. Right? They use a hierarchy of headings to provide context, navigation, and understanding of importance.
Well-designed websites are a good example of this. So if you think about a website that's been really well designed, the US IRS website has a series of headings. So at the top level, they have individuals, international taxpayers, businesses, self-employed, and government entities. So that's five big groups of people who might be involved in taxes or interested in information about taxes. So if you take one of those top-level things, if you take individuals, on the next level, they have how to file your taxes, when to file your taxes, where to file your taxes, and the information they have about you. And under international taxpayers and government and so on, they have other information. So if you're an individual and you're thinking, okay, I need to know something specific about how I file and how I can file for free, you go to the individual section and then you look at how to file. That makes sense. Like, that's the thing I want to know more about. So you click on that and that takes you down to information about how to determine how you should file, like your filing status, how you can file for free, how you can file on the internet, and the mailing addresses that you can send your taxes to. That information, that hierarchy, directs you to the information that you're looking for, the specific piece of information that you're looking for. And so when you're writing, if you're creating a long document, and even if you're creating an email that's three or four paragraphs, you could also do this same hierarchy thing to help people understand where they are in the document. The highest level, the top level, would be in the biggest writing. Often people make that twice as big as the body text and bold. And then the second level titles would be slightly smaller than that, but still bigger than the body text. And so if you knew you were looking for the third thing in the second level, you can look through the document and you can find, okay, there's the first time that size type appears, and I want the third type. So then you carry on your finger through the document and you see the second one and then the third one. And that, just the difference in size and type, has guided you through the document to help you find what it is that you need.
So you want to do this in your documents and writings as well. Anything that's longer than three paragraphs should have additional context, either as an explanation at the beginning or an outline, table of contents, system of headings, or one or more of them, right? The longer the document, the more help someone might need to navigate that document, irrespective of their language. But that doesn't mean that short documents or emails don't also benefit from metadata. They absolutely do, especially when you're communicating with somebody across a language barrier. It's helpful to them in that they can then take that data to help them navigate what you've written.
Next up, we have send materials ahead of time. So if you're going to present or have a meeting about the information in a document, then send the document ahead of the presentation or the meeting. Now, this can be frustrating because people will ask questions about it. And if you're a high D like me, you'll be annoyed because you're having a meeting. You wrote it all out, you took the time to write it, and you're having a meeting. You don't want to answer questions in between. However, there are two of the other people on the DIS profile prefer to read stuff ahead of meetings and discussions and prepare for it. And that's universal. That's not across language. That's not a language thing. It's just that 50% of the population likes to read and prepare things before they go into a meeting or any other kind of thing. So you will have a better response to your ideas if you allow those people to see what you're going to present ahead of time. And those people that don't like to prepare, they'll see your email and they'll just ignore it. You're not bothering the people who don't want to prepare because they will just ignore it. But you're making the people who do want to prepare, you're making those very happy.
Mm-hmm. And if you're adding in a language barrier, sending those materials ahead of time allows some people to look up words and concepts that are not familiar to them. Right? They need that time to absorb it, to do some research to ensure that they get what you're saying. High D's and I's will probably still not do it. And yeah, there are high D's and I's that no matter the country of origin or ethnic background of the person are going to behave this way. The reason is because they don't like to prepare and generally don't mind asking their questions in public. However, more reserved people will be more grateful for the opportunity to read and translate ahead of time because they're likely to be the people in your audience, in your crowd, that aren't comfortable speaking up, right, or drawing attention to the fact that they don't understand. So having that additional time ahead of time will be really beneficial to those individuals that don't want to ask questions anyway.
We should do the quick 2-minute description of DISC. So if you don't know what the high SIC thing is, it's a technology called DISC. It's a profile that you answer 28 questions and it tells you about the behaviors that you engage in work, in your everyday life. It's amazing. You will be completely shocked at how they know you from 28 questions. And once you know what you are and you can then look at other people and know what they are, and that helps you work better together. So there is a ton of stuff. Just go to the website, type in DISC in the search box. You can take the profile on our website, but you can also listen to lots and lots of podcasts about DISC and how to use it.
And also, as far as sending things in advance, it's wonderful, but you also want to remember that it's going to take people who have different languages to the one that you're using longer to read and understand than if the audience you were sending your materials ahead of time to were the same language as you. So if you're sending something for approval, you want to give that person, those people, twice as long as you yourself might need to review and respond to that same material because of these types of things. You can also go back to our guidance about using short, simple words, avoiding idioms and contractions to apply to this type of written communication as well.
Hey everyone, Kate here. The latest update to the Manager Tools app includes the ability to track coaching and delegation with Roadmap. So if you're a licensed member, you can access Roadmap through the Manager Tools application. And now that app will track all of your Trinity behaviors, including coaching and delegation. Figure out who to coach and on what using Roadmap. It'll even walk you through the steps and help you to set goals and deliverables around coaching. You can also add photos of your notes to each coaching instance to keep track of your handwritten one-on-one notes for that particular coaching scenario. Use Roadmap to decide the who, what, and how of delegating to your team members, all within the recommended timeframes for Trinity rollout. We'll remind you when and how. It's like having the Trinity in your pocket.
That's all for this week. We'll finish up this class next week.